Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast from the New Books Network. I'm Michael Vann, your host, but you can call me Mike. Today I'll be talking with Dr. Kim Wagner, Professor of British Imperial History at the University of London, Queen Mary. Dr. Wagner is a prolific historian and quite the storyteller, and the author of several books. These include Thugi, Banditry and the British in Early 19th Century India, Stranglers and Bandits, a historical anthology of Thugi, The Great Fear of 1857, Rumors, Conspiracies, and the Indian Uprising of 1857, and The Skull of Alam Beg, The Life and Death of a Rebel of 1857. And a few months ago, my very first podcast for New Books in History was on The Skull of Alam Beg. So I strongly recommend going back, listening to that podcast, and also grabbing the book. It is a wonderful, wonderful micro-history of about 1857. But today, we'll be talking about his latest book, Amritsar 1919, An Empire of Fear and the Making of a Massacre, with Yale University Press 2019. Now, from its opening pages, Dr. Wagner tells the readers he wants to challenge the way that the massacre has been recorded in popular and official memory. Indeed, the book starts with a description of the 1982 film by Richard Attenborough, Gandhi, and its recreation of the massacre in Amritsar. And he notes that And the opening of the book that he wants to challenge this sort of received image of what the massacre was. So welcome to New Books in History, Kim.
Hi, Mike. Thank you for having me again.
So, yeah, and you're a returning champion. So please tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to be a historian of the Raj and someone who's written several books on violence and on the British Empire in India.
Well, I've always been interested in the history of British Empire and sort of childhood fascination with the Thugs, with colonial conspiracies and violence, kind of just stuck with me. And really, I'm a 19th century historian, which is why I've written about the Thugs and the 1857 uprising. And the Amritsar Massacre was sort of my first foray into the 20th century, but one that I kind of felt was necessary.
Yeah, well, welcome to the 20th century. As someone who mostly works on the 20th century, we're happy to have you. It's Thanks. Quite the century. It ends all right.
Wow.
So in the book, you discuss obviously the book is about violence, and you discuss the role of violence in British rule in India, and you state British rule in India, in other words, was sustained by the application of exemplary violence, and this became one of the founding narratives of the colonial state in India after 1857. So, can you expand upon that? What was the role of this exemplary violence? How was it a tool of governance? And also, maybe you could talk about what's different about violence in the colonial empire than violence within a nation state in Europe or violence within the Chinese dynasty or an empire in West Africa. What's special about colonial violence?
That's a really good question. And it's one that I am in some ways still working on to elaborate. Because if you sort of disaggregate the actual components of any kind of state violence, really, they do look somewhat similar. Villages have been burned, throughout history, whether it's been in Europe or the extra-European world. Civilians have been targeted. The laws of war, such as they were, have been, you know, pushed aside and ignored. But what I think makes colonial violence something that's quite distinct is the logic that sort of justifies it. And so much of when you look at the violence of European or Western empires, what really sets it apart is the justification and the rationale that's presented, where the sort of the basic moral framework is quite interestingly one, which is about essentially when we're talking about the 19th century and the early 20th century, the civilizing mission, which means that colonial wars are by definition just wars. So there's never really any question as to whether or not what the colonizers do is justified. And then it really becomes an issue of justifying the specific kinds of violence that you see. And one of the things that struck me when I worked on 1857 and the kind of really brutal and demonstrative executions and mass violence that you saw is that it's not about punishing the guilty. It's not sort of an eye for an eye or something like that. It's not justice in a European sense of the word. It's purely performative. It's about sending a message about the strength of colonial authority. And because it's a colonial situation, you don't have this sort of Foucauldian scenario in which the public, the spectators who are witnessing a public execution, to some extent have to acknowledge the justness of the state. They don't have to approve of what's going on. Rather, they are direct recipients of the violence. So colonial executions, for instance, are targeted at the entire indigenous population, who are all potentially criminals in the sense that they might potentially resist colonial rule. So I think what sets colonial violence aside is the ways that violence is assumed to work and what levels of violence are presumed to be necessary to maintain colonial rule. And one of the things that really struck me when working first on 1857 and later on the subject of this book is the continuities that you really see between the 19th and the 20th century, which, as far as I'm concerned, are really underexplored within the historiography.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and you mentioned the executions around 1857, and this is the much of the subject of your last book, The Skull of Olembeg, and you know the types of executions that they're doing are, you know, the most famous thing is tying the accused to a cannon and shooting off the cannon and blowing them to pieces in front of hundreds or thousands of assembled sepoys, South Asian troops, and also civilians as well, right? So it has this performative or pedagogical component.
Yeah, I mean, this is communicative violence, and it's one that in a strange way is reflexive of cultural sensitivity, if you want. It's the instrumentalization of Orientalism and colonial knowledge, because the destruction of the body is meant to prevent proper burial, both according to Hindu and Muslim tradition, which of course means that this is not just state violence or even sort of colonial military violence as we usually think of it, but it's actually a type of spiritual warfare in which the colonial state seeks to culturally calibrate the kind of violence that's inflicted.
Right. And that it's done as, again, this performative violence, this act to teach those who are viewing the execution and to scare them. It also, the discussions of colonial violence also make me think about sort of the unequal colonial arithmetic. There was an headline in the satirical website, The Onion, about 15 years ago, and it was something along the lines of the equivalent of four Americans were killed in Afghanistan today. And the joke was that, you know, four American lives is equal to some other number of Afghan lives. And, you know, was it 40? Was it 400? Do you see that sort of asymmetric importance of the value of white lives versus colonial subject lives in this setting, in this history?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, if we see similar things today, they originate in the colonial context and in the colonial encounter. I don't want to sort of jump the gun and talk too much about Amritsar, but when you look at the disparity in casualties among civilians, it's extremely striking that half a dozen Europeans is an enormous tragedy, while hundreds of Indian civilians is just simply, you know, unfortunate. But that is indeed, right. You know, speaks to the very logic of the racial hierarchies that underpins so much of the enactment of colonial violence then and now.
Yeah, and you argue in the book that those who would see Amritsar as this aberration are ignoring the fact that this is actually the standard practice of colonial violence throughout the empire, correct?
Yes. I mean, if we think about, it's difficult to write about the British Empire today during sort of an era of Brexit and resurgent empire nostalgia without making a broader argument about the nature of the empire. And the Amritsar massacre is often invoked sort of in a tokenistic way as, yes, you know, there was the, and I have this in my book, it's a Daily Mail piece that talks about the occasional massacre, and that's a direct quote. And so people would obviously talk about Amritsar or mention Amritsar, maybe Bloody Sunday in Ireland, or they'll talk briefly, you know, mention Mau Mau as these sort of exceptional moments when rogue officers went off script and sort of let the side down. But they're really sort of the exceptions that prove the rule, presumably, which is about the empire essentially as being a force for good in the world. So Amritsar becomes the sort of the token bone you throw liberals to show you, yes, of course, there were some unfortunate incidents, but by and large, we did good when we used to run the world. And that's, of course, politically, a quite impoverished analysis, but also historically, it simply doesn't stand up to closer scrutiny, since the very logic that underpinned all these events really tie together both these sort of exceptional massacres with the everyday violence. So the same logic, the same colonial logic that allowed a British soldier to kick his servant to death and get away with it is not that different from the logic that sort of dictated these forms of performative violence on a much larger scale. And I think that it's really important to not just focus on the big events, in quotation marks, but rather link the exception to the norm and show how they're linked. Because otherwise, you are just talking about a few sort of fluke events, and that's certainly not the case here.
Right, right. Now, also, in this discussion of colonial violence, there's certain kinds of violence that can be inflicted on black and brown bodies that would not be inflicted on white bodies, either in the empire or back at home. I mean, there's violence against strikes and protests in England at the time, but these kind of things simply wouldn't happen to white bodies, correct?
Yes, that's one of the defining characteristics of colonial violence, that it is defined by what has been described as the rule of colonial difference, which is, as you already alluded to, the fact that indigenous non-white people don't count for as much as white people do, but also that they have to be punished or defeated in different ways. And that really sort of comes back to the notion of the violence as being communicative. That it doesn't really matter who is executed or who is shot when you're putting down a riot. It's simply the violence as an end in and of itself. Because right, since we're talking about a colonial situation, Western imperial powers are always ruling through coercion rather than consent, regardless of the sort of number of local allies who support colonial rule. At the end of the day, the only thing that really, the only guarantee of colonial authority is brute force. And that's, we kind of see that sort of being expressed in the purest form during these moments of crisis.
Yeah, excellent. So in the introduction, you write the following. I'm going to read a somewhat extended quote here. "In this book, I have sought to show the interplay between a colonial mentality rooted in the 19th century and the contingencies of the unrest in 1919, an awareness of and attention to the various temporalities at play within a single event that I have elsewhere referred to as, quote, thick periodization. The approach I have taken in this book might perhaps be described as a microhistory of a global event." And then you continue, "Whereas most studies of Amritsar focus on its aftermath, its political impact, and the public debates and legal issues it raised, that is, the massacre as a historical watershed, I focus narrowly and unapologetically on how events unfolded at Amritsar during April 1919. In doing so, I have sought to uncover the local dynamics of escalation, which reached their violent climax at Jallianwala Bagh, through the different experiences of a range of individuals, British and Indian, men and women." So I want to ask you, I really love this term, thick periodization. What do you mean by this? And I assume you're playing on Geertz's thick description. And can you sort of unpack that term?
Yes. So the Amritsar massacre is usually or almost exclusively discussed within the historiography as the sort of opening shot of the resistance movement in India, and the sort of the first, the beginning of the process that leads inexorably to independence in 1947. And it's really only as the catalyst that it is considered to be important. So it's in many ways, the historical analysis of the Amritsar massacre has been overdetermined by what later happens in a sort of a, you know, conventional teleological fashion. And it's for me, it's really unsatisfactory to read about an event when people don't really care about it, but only kind of, they can't wait to get the massacre over and done with and move on to the important stuff, which is about the nature of British rule in India and Gandhi and the change of politics. There's sort of an impatience with the nitty-gritty details, because what really matters within the conventional analysis is what follows, you know, decades later. And so I kind of wanted to push aside the historiographical status of the massacre and rather look at, well, nobody in April 1919 knew that this was a watershed. Nobody knew that, you know, two decades later, the British would leave India. So what happens if we push aside everything, or, you know, obviously we can't ignore what we know, but if we at least sort of pretend that this could have been a blip, and maybe, you know, the British had remained in India for 100 years, all sorts of things could have happened. People didn't know that at the moment. I think we really lose something in terms of historical insight because of our own, you know, perspective, which is obviously teleological. So that was one thing I was trying to do. But then the thick periodization thing is really about the reason I even, you know, ended up writing a book about Amritsar is because of my earlier work on 1857. It was just so many continuities. And then I started to realize that rather than seeing the Amritsar massacre as this sort of post First World War / Wilsonian moment, really a product of its time. It's sort of, this is when so many books begin. They begin, you know, 1918, 1919, and, you know, that's the interwar period. We have this sort of established chronology. Really, it's not the beginning of the end of British rule. Analytically, it makes more sense to look at it as the final stages of a much longer process, which for me, as I argue at least, began in the 19th century. And when you look at mm-hmm. how the British are experiencing these chaotic weeks and months in the spring of 1919, they're not thinking about the post First World War crisis. They're thinking about things that happened in the 19th century. So these what I've referred to as a mutiny motif, the sort of deep-seated, almost paranoid colonial mindset, shaped the way that British colonial officials and British civilians in India, even after the First World War, experienced what is the emergence of anti-colonial nationalism as a mass movement. And so a thick periodization, yes, it is a play of Geertz and probably also a bit pretentious to try and coin in a phrase like that, but trying to really get to grips at the way that people, they interpret the chaos around them through whatever precedents that they invoke. And in 1919, it was events six decades earlier that they were thinking of. So that's the, you know, that's what I'm trying to get at with that terminology.
Yeah, no, I think it's an excellent, a very, very thought-provoking term. I also love the phrase "microhistory of a global event." Can you expand upon that? I mean, you said it's they don't understand it as a watershed at the time, but then you go on to call it this microhistory of a global event. So what do you mean by that?
Well, originally I thought I would write a global history of the Amritsar massacre, and I thought I would write about, you know, what's going. This is, I mean, the unrest in India, you know, coincides with the Egyptian Revolution and the Irish War of Independence is kicking off. There's so much going on here that is in many ways tied together. So I thought, you know, clearly a global history is the way to go. But the more I looked at it, and the more I looked at the sort of street level, you know, the dynamic of the riots and then sort of the individuals' letters that were being written, is no. There are very few references to what else is going on in the world at the moment. And then sort of as you start working, I researched this for many years and you get a lot of time to think about how best to narrate it. I realized, you know, if I could just get the basic facts right and kind of put the reader on the scene at the moment when things happened at the most detailed level possible, I'd be quite happy with that. I think there's something, I mean, this is not the first book about the Amritsar massacre. And I think there is a particular and quite problematic dynamic that happens when historians and writers, they write about big events, well-covered events. It's what I would call the Titanic effect or the D-Day effect. That they never go back to scratch. You know, when you have, you know, 20, 50 other books on the subject written before the one you're writing, very few people go back to scratch. Very few people revisit the original sources. And therefore, they kind of just build on what is already there. And so what I really wanted to do was, I mean, I actually deliberately didn't read all the secondary works on the Amritsar massacre till later, and I wanted really to get into the primary material in the sort of most sort of intimate sense, precisely because the mm-hmm. Amritsar massacre has this particular status both within empire but also South Asian history.
Right. I mean, it's, you know, you talk about this historical teleology, and it's, you know, that's an issue for historians. But it also has an impact on how we understand, Indian and British imperial political history. I mean, people have made use of this event for the next century at this point, correct?
Yeah, and it's still used today to best, you know, just as a throwaway remark, but it's never understood on its own terms. The Amritsar massacre has mm-hmm. become a metaphor for the empire as a morally, you know, deeply problematic proposition without any real attempt at understanding what happened. So some historical events are sort of so big that we cease to care about what actually happened, and it becomes more like just sort of the bumper sticker value of the way that they're invoked.
Right. Yeah. Which leads me to another quote, a little shorter quote that I want to read. And this is very similar to something you wrote in The Skull of Alam Beg. You essentially give your readers a political disclaimer when you write, quote, "My particular take on the events of the Amritsar massacre will not appeal to everyone. And for those who prefer their Raj nostalgia or their Indian nationalist mythology to go unchallenged, there are literally dozens of books that will provide reassuring and politically edifying narratives. This book is not that." So how does this book challenge Raj nostalgia, and how does it challenge Indian nationalist mythology?
I think the way both the public debate, but also much of the historiography today, is still mired in this oversimplistic balance sheet approach that either the British Empire was generally a force for good and the Amritsar massacre is an unfortunate event, but an exception, therefore does not represent anything bigger. It's an anomaly. That would be the empire nostalgic take on it, which means you somehow have to explain it away as a fluke, or the opposite argument, which you find and which is quite popular, particularly in India today, namely that the British Empire was satanic and one long sequence of massacres, and it was the massacre itself was carefully planned and carried out because the British were evil racists, and they were to some extent. But neither of these approaches are really, I think it's quite self-evident that they're not adequate if we want to understand what actually happened. And I'm sufficiently old-fashioned to think that making sense of what appears to be senseless acts is what we should be doing. And I don't really care if I hurt people's feelings in that respect. I mean, I challenge a lot of Indian nationalist assumptions and popular assumptions about the massacre as well, because we simply don't have the evidence for a number of things. But I have that disclaimer just to signal that I don't really, I don't consider myself to take sides, whereas so much of the debate today is about, well, you know, was it good? Was it bad? Guilt, shame, pride, these kind of just very emotive and deeply unhelpful ideas are floating around in the debate.
Right. So you touched upon this already, but I wanted to ask you to expand upon this. And that's the question of the memory of the mutiny of 1857. And again, as you note in the Skull of Alam Beg, the memory is so important for the British experience in India. So looking at this case of Amritsar in 1919, how are the Britishers remembering the mutiny? How are they remembering 1857, and what sort of tropes do they fall into?
So the reason why the 1857 uprising figures or looms so large in the British colonial imagination is that you do have these massacres of European civilians, including women and children, and British colonial rule was indeed threatened in 1857. It's quickly restored brutally. But what the British, they take away, and this is why it's so problematic about, you know, this sort of people who don't learn from the past are doomed to repeated. In this case, the British, they take the wrong lessons away from 1857, which is about their hold of India ultimately depends on the application of force as a backup, regardless of liberal rhetoric, but also a deep-seated fear of indigenous conspiracies. I just heard a podcast about conspiracy theory in America and how much, you know, how largely it loomed in the era around the American Revolution and even before that. And there's just something very similar going on in terms of the way that rumors, panic, and the sort of projected fears, they shape British interpretations of the indigenous populations that they're governing. So by the time we get to 1919, the notion of legitimate anti-colonial protest movements is inconceivable. The idea is that British rule is perceived as being just and a good thing. So if you resist British rule, clearly you don't have a legitimate cause. And the gullible masses whom the British are protecting in sort of a traditional paternalist sense, so they tell themselves, must have been manipulated by Western educated agitators. And so the way that the British, they read Indian protests or unrest is just deeply distorted and carries this imprint of 1857.
Excellent. Yeah. So you start the book, as I mentioned, describing Attenborough's recreation of the massacre. And then you make us wait 160 plus pages before you actually get to the massacre. And I'll note that the part of the subtitle of the book is The Making of a Massacre. So why is it so important that you spent time focusing on the events in the weeks leading up to the April 13th massacre?
It actually comes in part, at least, from a really brilliant article by Jordana Belkin called The Boot and the Spleen, in which she argues about trying to make sense of violence. And she says there's nothing more banal than, you know, pointing out that, you know, colonialism was defined by violence and that there's this tendency to almost taking it for granted. But what we really need to do as historians and scholars is to, well, try and unpack it and see how it's presumed to work and the effects it actually has. And so I was always kind of troubled by the previous attempts at describing the Amritsar massacre, which sort of to say, oh yeah, there's a bit of unrest in the spring, and then, you know, we have a massacre, and then we move on to the more important thing. And for me, it's the events, it's the days preceding the massacre on the 13th of April 1919 and the unrest that engulfs Amritsar in the Punjab in northern India that really allows us to make sense of what happens. So it's about taking context seriously in some way.
And the film Gandhi actually does a pretty terrible job with that context, correct? I mean, The scene starts with someone giving a speech that's, you know, presenting the sort of the Gandhian techniques of nonviolence, the importance of ahimsa, and so forth. And then the massacre just is unleashed, and it is this, it sort of comes as a bolt out of a blue, correct?
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be, there's no reason, there's no rhyme or reason for why it happens. The only thing you can sort of say is, oh, you have this horrible sort of brutal, stiff upper lip, broom, mustache, steel-eyed Edward Fox representing General Dyer. So he also embodies the violence of the empire, you know, as an individual, which makes it an ad hominem explanation for the violence. But also it requires no reason. So in the Gandhi movie, it's just sort of plonked in there in the middle of the narrative about Gandhi to show that the sort of the mobilization of mass protests against the British and the strength of Gandhi's, you know, message of nonviolence was such as to provoke a violent British, you know, response that was sort of irrational and to some extent demonstrated the truth of Gandhi's message. And that's really reducing the massacre to just sort of a brief sort of incident in this what I've always referred to, this much longer trajectory about the Indian struggle for independence, and you know that comes to fruition 2 decades later. But this assumption that you don't actually have to make sense of colonial violence, it just happens because the colonizers are racist and brutal. And it also presents this very, very easily digestible narrative about villains and victims. And it is, of course, difficult not to talk about victims when we're looking at something like the Amritsar massacre. Yet again, I would say it doesn't help us understand what happens if we simply see one side as the villains and the others as the victims.
Mm-hmm. So what are some of the specific events that happened in Amritsar and in the Punjab in the days leading up to April 13th? You talk about the Rowlatt Act, also known as the Anarcho and Revolutionary Crimes Act. You touch upon the impact of the Spanish flu, the flu pandemic, and other forces. So what are the key events and key sort of pressures on Amritsar in the spring of 1919?
So the end of the First World War does not bring relief. India has quite remarkably been the population has been extremely supportive of the British war effort on the assumption that this sort of expression of loyalty. I mean, there's more than a million Indians who either fight for the British or otherwise serve the British as carriers in the Middle East, in the Mesopotamia, and the Western Front as well. And there's huge amounts of resources and money that are actually help to fight the Germans. And so there's this expectation that Indian loyalty will be rewarded at the end of the war, and this sort of global disruption of trade, the impact of the flu pandemic, there's sort of a succession of failed harvests and famines. This all sort of expresses itself in the spring of 1919 when the British, instead of rewarding Indian support for the war, decide to continue the wartime emergency measures. And so there are reforms, the Montagu-Chelmsford reforms, but they're really quite limited and to some extent simply, you know, tokenistic. So there's this expectation which is followed up by extreme disappointment. And then you have the British, continuing the wartime emergency measures, which makes them look like the brutal Prussians that they've just been, you know, fighting and lobbing propaganda at for 4 years. And that really gives rise to Gandhi's mass movement, which protests these emergency legislation. And from British perspective, the idea is that you reward loyal Indian politicians who are willing to work within the empire. Nobody's talking about independence at this point in time, but you also retain all these really quite draconian measures, which means you can arrest people, keep them without trial, and you know, shut down the press and these kind of things to keep revolutionaries in check. So there's a notion of the carrot and stick, and the idea is that you can deploy them in a very sort of careful way. But of course, it's quite obvious to many Indians at the time that really the British, they rather than loosening their grip on India, they're actually tightening it quite significantly. But from a British perspective, mm-hmm. these protests are not justified. They're not legitimate. One of the reasons being that there's no real recognition that Indian nationalism is a legitimate sentiment, or that one could reasonably protest against British rule. So we see in the spring
in that context, there's a couple of specific events that happen in the days leading up. Correct? There's demonstrations and riots.
Yeah. So, I mean, you have these, for the first time, you have mass meetings of tens of thousands of people meeting and listening to political speeches and nationalist songs. Again, they're talking about reforms within the empire and something like dominion status. They're not calling for independence. But the way that the British are perceiving it, and, you know, we've got the sort of the spy report, Secret Service observers, you know, recording what's happening. And what they see is sort of the potential for another uprising. I mean, this is not that long after the Russian Revolution. So there is a heightened sense of fear in that sense. And the British, they think that by arresting local leaders, they can sort of shut down the protests, because the idea is that people have no real reason to protest. And so if you just get rid of these seditionists, as they're referred to, then everything will be calm. But the opposite happens. The British, they preemptively arrest the political nationalist leaders in Amritsar. And what they've actually done is they've removed the leaders from a popular mass movement that tried to make it into the European lines. This is, of course, a racially fairly segregated colonial sort of urban landscape. And the Indian protesters, they think they are negotiating with the authorities to call for the release of their leaders, whereas the British, they see sort of the native masses, you know, charging across the railway tracks and invading what is essentially perceived as a white space. And this triggers this panic reaction. And so British military and police open fire and kill a number of protesters. And that situation then escalates on the 10th of April, 1919. And that leads to the quite brutal murders of five European civilians inside the Indian part of the city. That should be seen in the context of 20, 30 Indian rioters being shot and killed. And that really triggers those sort of 1857 memories. There's also, infamously, a female missionary who's cycling through Amritsar, and she's attacked, beaten, and left for dead. And that sort of is perceived by the British authorities as a sexual attack that, again, pointed back to sort of the nightmare scenario of 1857.
Mm-hmm. And it reveals the importance of sort of the gender nature of some of these acts of violence or perceived acts of violence. That it's one thing to kill a white man, but when you touch a white woman, there's a whole different set of revenge that's going to be brought out, correct?
Yeah, and those very words, the British officials at the time, they say that, you know, five European civilians, men being effectively lynched by Indian crowds was not nearly as bad as this female missionary being attacked, because that is an attack on sort of the very sort of edifice of British rule in India. And of course, it challenges implicitly white masculinity, which then has to be restored through violence. And then we kind of know what's going to happen next.
And then, of course, that resonates with America's history of lynching and the allegations of a black man, you know, even whistling at a white woman could lead to, you know, truly horrifying acts of violence and revenge. But the Indian rioters also attack something else very important to the British. They attack the bank, right?
Yeah. So they attack every sort of physical manifestation of British authority. Since they can't actually enter the European lines, they turn their anger on the telegraph office, the post offices. They tear down telegraph lines and attack.
Which is something the Boxers did as well.
Yeah. I mean,
in China, the Boxer Rebellion tore down telegraph lines.
And then the Indian rebels did in 1857. I mean, it's one of the most obvious manifestations of colonial rule is telegraph lines and railway tracks and train stations, which of course also looks like it's a pre-coordinated anti-colonial, you know, resistance movement. But really, it's just the most natural thing. When we're looking at these sort of moments of colonial crisis, you attack the visible symbols of colonial rule, another one being churches, of course. These attacks, they're both brutal, but they're also embodied in sort of the symbolism of a challenge to British rule. And then the female missionary, for instance, she's beaten, but the young men who attack her, they take off their slippers and hit her with their slippers, which is a sign of disrespect. So we can see the logic of that kind of crowd violence.
It's like throwing a shoe at the white invader, be it Amritsar or be it a press conference with President George W. Bush in Baghdad, correct?
Indeed.
So in terms of the massacre itself and the British violence inflicted upon Indian bodies, General Dyer is the figure most associated with this violence. What can you tell us about him? And what did his experience in the empire bring? What experience in the empires did he bring to the Bagh in April 1919?
Well, other historians have tried to explain that he was a unique character and that he was irascible, he had irritable bowel syndrome, and he was traumatized by his First World War experience. None of this really makes sense because General Dyer was not that atypical. He had served in Burma in the 1880s. He had been in Ireland for a bit, and he was in the Middle East during the First World War. He was not a particularly famous or noted officer. But after the riots that have happened, there is from official hold this idea that something needs to be done, that an example has to be set. And so General Dyer is only the third officer within 24 hours who is sent to Amritsar in order to restore British authority. And the two previous ones are replaced when they fail to take drastic measures. So General Dyer, he turns up with this sort of empire experience, which requires non-white people to be, the logic is that the only language non-white people understand is violence, and it has to be unflinching and quick in order to nip further unrest in the bud. And so that's what General Dyer does on the 13th of April, which is also a large religious festival. So Amritsar was full of pilgrims as well. He heard about, he had banned political meetings, order had been restored, peace at least, and he heard there was a big gathering deep inside the old Indian part of the city. And this is when the analysis, I think it's interesting to actually sort of stop and look at the different steps that happens, because the way that the massacre itself is depicted in the Attenborough movie is one of peaceful protesters literally quoting Gandhi, and then you have this brutal colonial officer in a pith helmet rolling up with armored cars and troops and carry out a massacre, and it makes no sense, and that's, you could say, in one way that's what happened. But if you actually look at the General Dyer, he provided five quite detailed accounts of his actions and explained it at some length later on. What he saw in front of him was not a peaceful crowd. He perceived it as a war situation, and he was entering a war zone, which is why he brought armored cars. He stationed British troops all around Amritsar, not in order to surround the city, but rather to extricate him and his men in case they were ambushed. So the scenario that's in front of General Dyer is something more like Black Hawk Down. And he literally thinks he might be ambushed by rebels. And he refers to the entire population of Amritsar as rebels. And the moment you realize that, you know, he's not experiencing the actual situation in front of him. What he's experiencing is some kind of paranoid reoccurrence of the 1857 uprising. Sadly, his actions, you know, make sense within that framework. And so when he comes across this massive gathering, which is about between 10 and 20,000 men, women, and children, a lot of them are simply there for picnics. It's sort of a popular spot. Some are just resting. There's gamblers there. There's children playing. There's a small political meeting taking place. he thinks he's caught the rebels, and he simply acts immediately. He marches in with 50 armed troops and opens fire at point blank range. And this is, the Jalan Wallabagh is this big enclosure. It's a open space. A park is too nice of a word for what it is. It's sort of a bit of a wasteland, but it's really like shooting fish in a barrel. So the 50 troops, they fire for 10 minutes and they fire 1,650 rounds. And people have nowhere to run because there are only four small exits that quickly get blocked up. So people stampede and you know, trample on each other. And the result is absolutely devastating. The British, they eventually acknowledged or accepted that 379 people had been killed and about three times that wounded. And my research would lead me to suggest that something like 500 to 600 people were killed and three times that wounded. With that said, we'll never know exactly how many. And you could also say that the exact numbers don't really matter. It's not more or less of a monstrosity, you know, regardless of whether 300 people died or 1,000 people died, doesn't really change how horrific it was.
Yeah, that's similar to the work I've been doing on the Indonesian's military's destruction of the Indonesian Communist Party. And was it 500,000 that they killed? Was it 1 million? Was it 1.5 million? Was it 3 million, as one general responsible for the murders claimed? When you're juggling hundreds of thousands of murdered people, the exact number starts to become irrelevant. And actually, I think that the vagueness about that number, when you've got such mass atrocities, underlines the point that this was something truly, truly horrific. So, in the days following the massacre, you talk about this in Forces of Terror about April 14th to April 30th. How did British repression continue after this the massacre itself on April 13th?
A curfew was put in place, which meant that those who were wounded after the massacre couldn't receive medical help, and a lot of people died from their wounds. But there's also public floggings, mass arrests, and in the street where this female missionary, she was attacked, the infamous crawling order is put in place, which requires all Indian men to crawl along the street on their bellies, and there are British guards put in place who are there for a week and who are basically urinating in the local well, killing pigeons in a nearby temple, and there are some boys who are said to have been the attackers of the missionary who are taken there and flogged publicly. So you have this sort of and these are referred to as fancy punishment, because the British are basically doing whatever they feel is required to restore colonial authority, which is basically, it's collective punishment. Electricity and water is also shut off to the entire city of Amritsar. And of course, Amritsar is only part of the wider unrest that takes place in Punjab.
All these various measures that follow up on the massacre itself, and, you know, purposely insulting. I mean, your description of the curfew keeping people from accessing the hospital, that was a real real eye opener for me.
Yes, and it speaks to the logic of colonial violence, which I think is not calculated. When General Dai is asked about it, he said, well, if people wanted medical aid, they could just ask for it. He said, well, he had actually enforced the curfew right after the massacre, making it impossible for people to receive aid. And I don't think it was this calculated evil mindset. I think it was complete callousness and indifference to Indian suffering, which speaks to a sort of a deep-seated, you know, kind of colonial mentality, which where racism plays a large role. And of course, none of this would be conceivable if the enemy, in inverted commas, had been white. I mean, even in Ireland and the sort of the policy of reprisals that takes place in the years in the following years, none of that gets anywhere near what happens in India in 1919.
Yeah, yeah. So I wanted to ask you about how the rest of the world came to know about the massacre and the general reaction. And maybe you can also talk about the Hunter Commission, which was the official inquiry into the massacre and what it was able to accomplish and what it was unable to accomplish.
Yeah, so because martial law is enforced, it means that there's a complete shutdown on press. So actually nobody really knows what happens. And it's only piecemeal that news escapes from Punjab. So actually Indian nationalists, including Gandhi, undertake their own independent investigation trying to find out what has taken place. And that kind of forces the British to actually try and find out what happened. So there was no interest really from official hold to find out how many people have been killed. That's something that they tried to find out months later when they were forced to it, because Indian nationalists were actually able to release and inform the press outside of Punjab about this. So the news, sort of the details of the massacre, don't reach London until December 1919, which is quite remarkable when you think about it. And it creates really a scandal and splits society, because it proves to those sort of more liberal-minded that conservative imperialism is an immorally unsustainable endeavor, while it makes the empire, at the same time, makes the empire really, really difficult to defend, which is indeed why Winston Churchill, he throws Dyer under the bus, and the government at the time criticizes Dyer for his actions. Dyer is really ill at that point of time in early 1920, and goes on sick leave, but is actually forced to relinquish his command. And he's got widespread support from the conservative press and a lot of conservative politicians. But he has to resign from the army. And so he loses part of his pension. But that's as far as it goes in terms of him being actually punished. But in many ways, the debate about the massacre really becomes a sort of a proxy debate about Ireland, which begins to consume British politics, but also the future of the British Empire. And so already at the time, it became this event that signified something else than sort of the actions themselves and what people had done. And Dyer becomes this guy who's the only one who's ever in any way really seen to be responsible for the violence, although he's by no means unique. I mean, it's one of the things I try to argue in the book, that there are talks about bombing Amritsar from the air with airplanes before Dyer even turns up. So, I mean, he's not. And you find other British officers who literally say the very same things that Dyer did. So the very idea that he's somehow.
So he's far from an aberration.
Yeah, you know, and I mean, I don't see how that notion could ever be, you know, sustainable, because it's almost like he's quoting from, you know, Calwell's Small Wars, the sort of military manual of colonial warfare, when he talks about setting an example, striking hard and don't showing weakness in the face of natives, in inverted commas. And you could say, to some extent, it would be nice to say that it was sort of the last gasp of a colonial mindset, and that after, you know, the lessons learned from the Amritsar massacre points towards a sort of more humane counterinsurgency strategy that sort of takes us past the Second World War into the wars of decolonization. But that's, of course, not true. I think the euphemisms are changed a bit, but the perceived necessity to inflict this kind of violence actually never goes away.
Mm-hmm. So General Dyer has official sanction, gets something equivalent to a dishonorable discharge, withdrawn from India, sent back to England, lose parts of his pension. But you mentioned the conservative press has a lot of support for him, but also the British in India and also many in the British civilian population at home. What do they think of him and how do they respond to him?
Well, he is, and this in some ways has some parallels to what's recently taken place in the US in terms of President Trump's pardon of war criminals.
The SEAL officer.
Yeah, and others. But General Dai is seen as a brave soldier who did his horrible duty, but who was thrown under the bus by liberal armchair politicians who put him in a dangerous position or situation in the first place. And so you have this outburst of popular support and a quite substantial sum of money, £26,000, are collected through public funds or public donations to him. English women in India, they collect money and sort of describes him as he saved them from the outrages of 1857 recurring. And that's when you can really see how this is really, it's not about the unrest in 1919 and the political turmoil and the rise of Indian nationalism as much as it is about this sort of 1857 as a nightmare scenario that still drives British perceptions of Indian unrest. The kind of the Morning Post, the ultra-conservative newspaper that organizes the collection for Dyer, they publish the names of the people who donate money, and it's sort of, some people donate £1, £2, 50 shillings, stuff like that. But the pseudonyms that they write under is always something like someone who can't forget 1857 or somebody who served in the empire. So, you know, General Dyer's case becomes really about the British Empire in a much larger debate about the changing nature of the global political landscape after the First World War.
Yeah, and as you pointed out, that has so much resonance with events today. It sounds like those could be similar Twitter handles of Trump supporters, you know, praising his amnesty of certain war criminals. What about the fate of O'Dwyer, who was the civilian head of the Punjab?
So he's actually tries to exonerate Dyer for a very long time. In 1924, there's a libel case. He sues an Indian politician for describing quite, you know, briefly that, you know, there was a reign of terror during martial law, which is objectively speaking accurate. But the Indian politician actually loses that case. And so that high court judgment in 1924 actually exonerates Dyer and says, you know, what he did was right and it was wrong for politicians to liberal politicians to disown him. So O'Dwyer's name becomes linked to that of Dyer. And Dyer himself, he has several strokes and he dies in 1927. But O'Dwyer is assassinated by an Indian nationalist, Udham Hussain, Udham Shahid, who in 1940, as sort of a belated revenge for, Udham Singh is his name.
21 years later.
Yeah. A Sikh called Udham Singh. And that is seen as, oh, this finally has the Amritsar massacre been avenged. But that time, of course, the Indian nationalist struggle has come underway and, many other things have happened. But that is the narrative today you see in India. At Jallianwala Bagh, there's a statue of Udham Singh outside of the main gate into Amritsar, the statue of Udham Singh. So the commemoration is very much about sort of heroic struggle, but also the avenging the Amritsar massacre and the sort of outburst of patriotic sentiments that it occasioned. And again, that's looking at the Amritsar massacre not as an event that has significance in and of itself, but more so as a catalyst of other people's heroic actions.
Right. Using that history for a political purpose. So in your conclusion, you discuss Prime Minister David Cameron's visit to Amritsar in 2013. Can you tell us about that and your take on his statement there?
Yeah, so there's been since the Queen, she visited Amritsar in 1997, and Prince Philip, he said something racist, as he's wont to do. She didn't apologize.
Prince Philip is particularly good at that.
He certainly is. David Cameron did not apologize. He quoted Churchill, actually, in saying this was a monstrous and isolated event, and that we have to remember the British, they stand for the freedom of speech. So you end up in this strange situation where call for an apology is actually used as an occasion to celebrate British exceptionalism and defense of liberal virtues, but no actual apology. And there was no apology in 2019 when Theresa May, she expressed regret, but no apology. What did happen, and which really surprised me, was that I think it was in September of 2019, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, he went to Amritsar and he prostrated himself in front of the Amritsar, the Jallianwala Bagh Memorial, and apologized in his capacity of a religious person. And so I actually thought that was a far more meaningful gesture, because historical apologies are really political rituals, I find it hard to see anything good coming from a conservative politician, British politician today, making some kind of circumscribed non-apology at the memorial. But of course, that's the issue of an apology divides opinions quite a bit.
All right, you're not holding your breath for Boris Johnson to deliver some eloquent words of healing.
Well, I mean, the question is whether you would want him to. I mean, he'd start quoting Kipling if he ever turned up at Amritsar, and I think sort of the backlash would potentially be quite disastrous. So no, I'm not holding my breath.
Okay. So you end the book with an epilogue that talks about the memorial site in Jallianwala Bagh today. And you mentioned this previously, but what's your critique of the memorial that's there right now?
It's not a critique as much as almost a bit of a sadness that the historical event has almost been completely effaced. There are some bullet holes left, but what you really see celebrated there is this nationalist myth of heroic sacrifice, and there's topiary soldiers there if you want to sort of gauge the somber atmosphere that's invoked by the park itself. There's a gallery of martyrs. I mean, this is very much the language we're talking about. There's a sign when you come inside the park that says this ground is hallowed by the mingled blood of 2,000 Hindus, Muslims, and Sikhs. So it's very much sort of a post-1947 secular nationalist narrative that's being celebrated. And that's just very, very...
And they use the number 2,000.
Yeah. I mean the numbers, you know... I mean, that's one of as a historian, I find frustrating how little the facts they matter at the very site of the event itself. I mean, there's something called the Martyrs' Well, where there's a sign that says 120 bodies were pulled out from this well, people who presumably fell into the well and drowned during the massacre. And I've looked at all the records, and the Indian nationalists at the time, they describe one or two people falling into the well. So these are just the kind of obvious sort of myths that grow up or that emerge at sites like this. So, I mean, really what I wanted to indicate is that we have to recognize that these big historical events don't simply happen. They're constructed afterwards. And to some extent, you can say the narrative of the Amritsar massacre that you find today is, to some extent at least, an invented tradition. And I'm not going to tell people that it's wrong and it's silly to believe in. I just want to say, you know, here's a different account.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So we've taken up a bunch of your time and really appreciate that. But before you go, can you suggest one or two books related to either Amritsar or studies of colonial violence that that you would recommend?
Well, I mean, this is a bit awkward, but I would highly recommend your work. You've written an absolutely brilliant.
No, this isn't awkward at all. This is delightful. Go on.
Well, but I mean, your work has been inspirational for me, and so you got a couple of absolutely brilliant articles on Fear and Loathing and Hanoi and of pirates, postcards, and beheadings. But more recently, you published your the Great Rat Massacre of Hanoi as a comic book from Oxford University Press, which is extremely original format, but also an absolutely brilliant historical analysis. So if I can recommend something, it would be your work.
Well, Kim, thank you. That's very nice. I'm very flattered. But aside from the Great Hanoi Rat Hunt, could you recommend two books pertinent to this conversation that the listeners would find valuable?
Well, yes, there is other than you, there's a lot of very good literature on colonial violence. One particular favorite of mine is Swedish travel writer Sven Lindqvist's Exterminate All the Brutes from the early 1990s, which is sort of part travelogue and part meditation on Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. And it's a fairly brief book, but it's really interestingly written and really engaging.
Yeah, that is a fabulous book, and it's brilliant the way that he links his reflections on colonial violence with the origins of the Nazi genocide.
Yes, and of course, since he wrote that, a lot of academics have sort of picked up on that. And of course, it points back to Hannah Arendt's work, ultimately.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a wonderful read. Do you have one more?
I'm a great fan of the work of Anne Stoller, which is not necessarily very accessible, but one of her articles is called In Cold Blood, which is about the murder of a Dutch planter family in Sumatra in the 19th century. And that's, I just absolutely love that article because it really brings out the complicated dynamics of colonial violence, but also how it's tied into particular narratives about colonial fears, essentially. I mean, it's one of the things that you have worked on as well, and you use this really evocative phrase, the deadly combination of white vulnerability and white power. And so Stoller's article really speaks to that.
Yeah, I am, as you know, a huge Anne Stoller fan, and I think that article might be folded into her one of her more recent books, Along the Archival Grain. I think that's a chapter in there, or at least she discusses that case. The article's in.
I published a version of that article in an edited volume called Engaging Colonial Knowledge about 10 years ago. Maybe that's what you're thinking of.
Okay, great. Yeah. Fantastic. Well, hey, so what are you working on now?
More violence, but this time American colonial violence in the Philippines in the early 20th century, which is sadly in many ways very relevant, as we have Donald Trump talking about General Pershing using pig's blood against terrorists, and he's alluding to the Philippines. So I'm trying to get the American side of the story, put it into the same analytical framework as we usually do with British, French, German colonial violence, because that really what I think is that all these Western imperial powers have far more in common than is usually assumed.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Well, as a Southeast Asianist, I welcome you to the region. You're going to love it. So that's great. Well, I look forward to seeing that work. And thank you for your time, Kim.
No, thank you for having me.
So this has been a discussion with Kim Wagner of the University of London, Queen Mary, about his new book, Amritsar 1919, An Empire of Fear and the Making of a Massacre, out with Yale University Press. I'm Michael G. Vann, and this has been an episode of New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. Thank you for listening.